Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which is on a mission to make America think again. It's what happens in the shadows that makes the difference. So tune in and listen. We're not going to tell you how to feel. We're not going to tell you who to vote for. We're just going to try and make you think. We're going to put the people out there that know what's going on so that you can have all the information you need, because a vote is a terrible thing to waste, folks. And we've got an election coming up in a couple of states that's very important. So get out there and vote. Welcome to my, I'm going to let Liberty Jones introduce our guest tonight. Welcome, Liberty.
Hi, thank you so much for having me, as always. I'm actually very excited for today's show because, as we do talk about, I think student activism has always been a leading force of mobilization and social movements in this country. And I'm proud to introduce a student and friend from the DC George Washington University, Chris. Chris is a senior and he is completing his bachelor's degree this semester in international affairs and public policy. And this is a great conversation to have, especially after the huge No Kings protests that we saw over this weekend. Pleasure to have you, Chris.
Hi. Yeah, thank you for having me here.
Yeah, no, I don't want to put you on the spot, Liberty, but did you go out to the No Kings rally?
Well, I definitely saw protesters, but I was not fully at the rally.
Okay. Okay. I saw him too on TV. I unfortunately was busy yesterday. As you know, we just moved. So I moved to an island in the Chesapeake Bay where I feel safe. But anyway, Chris, let's get started. You know, I'll ask you the first question, and that is that when I was a student, it was the middle of the Vietnam War. It was an issue that brought us all together, mostly because many of us were of draft age and could have been sent into a war that we didn't believe in. And so we were very active. And it bothers me sometimes that I see young people that aren't as active anymore. So tell me why you're active and what you do and what you think is important in being an activist.
All right. Well, I'll start off with like what I do in terms of like activism. I'd say I just try to engage as much with the student body and the student community to do, you know, physical protests, physical action within the campus area to make sure that our administration, local officials, including DC Council and federal government officials that live in the DC area, are aware that students and the future of like the generations, the future of the United States, care about issues like Palestine, care about issues about the mass detention of immigrants in the United States, care about issues that the Trump administration seems to be just doing the worst things in. So that's what I would say I would do. I mean, most recently, there's been a couple protests in the GW campus area, specifically to try to designate GW as a sanctuary campus. We're trying to get our president, Alan Granberg, to no longer engage with federal enforcement like ICE and other police agencies to make it so that our campus is safe for our students, our faculty, and our staff, regardless of their legal status. So that's what I would do. Why I do it would be because it matters, honestly. It's like, that's the best way to put it. It's because it matters, and also because of where I am. You know, it's the beauty of being in an urban area, the beauty of being in such an influential urban area. You think your existence in that space matters and how you use that space matters. And so if you're willing to disrupt that space, disrupt what usually goes on to show that something important is important, that's so much weight. And I think, you know, doing that sort of activity that shows, hey, I'm willing to break the day-to-day rhythms to show that something like this matters is the most valuable thing us as students can do, especially since we don't have a lot of money, we don't know a lot of people. You know, we're also not these high-level academics. We can't act like we know everything about everything. So just us saying, we're willing to mess everything up around us to show how much this matters is the most powerful.
Well, first, let me say that you give me great hope for the future. You know, and I'm glad to see that you are active and that you do you do it for the right reasons? Because I think you're right. I think it's important. And especially for students, because you are the future. And, you know, we always pay lip service to that, but then we turn around and ignore you guys a lot. Liberty, you want to ask a question?
Yeah, so I'm sure you guys saw, but Trump has made an effort to enact ceasefire. Even though I think it's important to mention that even though the ceasefire has provided temporary relief for Palestinian families, violence from Israeli settlers and forces continue in the West Bank and East Jerusalem. Showing that the struggle for Palestinian liberation is far from over. And this is a very interesting conflict, although very unfortunate, because U.S. administrations from Trump to Biden have continuously supported Israeli military and enabling repression of pro-Palestine voices. And now we're linking domestic systems like ICE to Israeli military attacks, further perpetuating these cycles of violence and oppression. So I think that I had a brief conversation this week with some Palestinian students as well, and they told me that something that they're deeply worried about is that people are very fast to talk about ICE and all the pain that Trump has brought upon this country. But we've mentioned to make the connection that Israeli military is being trained in very similar ways to ICE, and that a lot of these actual deportations that we're seeing have been with the goal of repressing these activist voices, which is truly the future. We've also failed to mention that this is a continuous issue in our political frame. Biden, although he did say nice things, he also was supportive, from what I understand, of Israeli military. So this is a continuous cycle, and it's something that no matter how we want to change the narrative, it is really difficult to see change. My first question to you is, what do you think is next in this movement? With something so connected to the current American pain we're facing, and yet something that we've worked so hard to actually see change in. You know, after fight and after fight, we protested, we got a ceasefire, except we still continuously see the same perpetual cycles. What do you think is the next step in this conflict?
Next step, and we're talking the like Palestinian liberation conflict and the general just conflict within the Middle East. That's what we're discussing right now,
Well,
specifically.
yeah,
Okay,
whatever you
yes.
think is best.
Sorry, I just wanted to say. I think, I mean, what's next is just further organizing and further voicing the opinions and the experiences of those that matter. Like, I'm so thankful that there is a ceasefire. I'm so thankful that there is less harm and less death occurring, but less isn't zero, and less doesn't create democracy, and less doesn't solve everything. So what we need is to first make sure that Trump and other officials within the United States, within Israel, around the world, we keep them accountable by making sure that this ceasefire isn't just a quiet ceasefire where, yes, they might not be dropping as many bombs, but they might still be storming random hospitals, storming random clinics, treating people like turds. So first, we need to hold people accountable by making sure that what they agree upon is maintained. That's step one. Step two is to continue pushing for further liberation, the democratization of government within that area, the liberation of thought. And that requires organization, that requires having politicians, like primarying politicians that care about this issue, primarying politicians that are willing to put their neck on the line for the Palestinian cause and for other causes similar to this, like the ICE immigration rates. We need to be willing to go out there, not just when Donald Trump is on the ballot, but when everyone else is on the ballot. We need to make it so that our voices are heard in every level of government, whether it be city council, senators, representatives. So we need to continue organizing. We need to make it known that these issues are going on. We need to make sure it's known that the struggle is still occurring so that people feel encouraged to actually voice their opinion, whether it be in the ballot box, whether it be by helping a campaign, whether it be by donating. But unless people know what's going on and they know that people care, they're not going to do anything. So continued organizing by those who care the most is necessary.
You know, the thing that worries me most, Chris, and I don't know that anybody has an answer to this problem, but haven't we created a whole new generation of, I don't want to call them terrorists, but let's say militants. Haven't we created a whole new generation of militants in Gaza? I mean, if somebody comes along and murders half your family or kills half your family, doesn't that turn you into a militant? I mean, what do we do to mitigate the hate? And I don't know that, you can. I mean, it's thousands of years old, but I feel, and tell me if you agree with this, I feel that we have a special obligation here, not only because of the humanitarian things, but because we were instrumental in putting together the Palestinian mandate that created this problem in the first place. I mean, maybe it
Yeah.
didn't create it, but it certainly exacerbated.
No, it
So,
definitely. Yeah. Sorry. Continue. Finish.
No, you go ahead, please.
So, I would say, I mean, yes, it's impossible to completely prevent the sort of hate that occurs, and I very much, it makes sense why a Palestinian individual who's gone through this experience, who has seen 90% of their family get murdered, has seen thousands of children die, has witnessed famine and starvation. It makes sense that you have anger towards the individuals, the people, the structures that made that okay. So, like, first off, I understand that experience. No, I don't understand. I sympathize with it. And beyond that, there are other examples of individuals, of conflicts in the world where you have turned, quote, militants into partners of the community. That is the number one goal of post-conflict work, it is to make sure that those who were in the conflict, those who were the soldiers, those who were victims of a conflict, are brought back into community, whether it's by making sure post-conflict economy actually includes them, by making sure their voices are heard. You know, this isn't just a thousand-year conflict, because no conflict is just bread and butter, something that occurs for thousands of years and can't be resolved. These are people who've lived for the past 50 years and have not witnessed the past 50 years, but they know these past 50 years aren't everything. So as long as you can show them there's something beyond this, and yes, hate occurred, but hate no longer will occur, I think you can end the militancy, maybe not end, but reduce, what is it, harm reduction, engage in harm reduction, make it so that the community feels the most repaired after this, which is a very difficult effort, and that requires experts in fields that I've not even studied before, but it is something that's possible. It's been done to an extent in post-FARC conflict Colombia. It's been done to an extent in Afghanistan when the United States was occupying it. It's occurred in the Balkans after years of like international conflict in that area. So post-conflict resolution isn't an impossibility. I'm sorry, was there more to the question?
I'm sorry. I hope you're right about that. And but yeah, that seems to be to me to be the real, really, really tough thing here is to try to mitigate that. And let me also ask you, I don't know if you know, but I hear this from Palestinian students, and it bothers me a little bit that they say that Israel has attacked Gaza, but they say Hamas has attacked Israel. Why don't they consider Hamas the government? They are the government, are they not?
I mean, it's the que it's a very this is going to be very nitpicky, but it depends on what you mean by a government. Are they the most powerful force with that is unified in Gaza outside of the IDF and outside of Israel? Yes, they're the ones with the most guns, with the most coordination, with the most organization. So you could consider them like a de facto government because of that. But the last elections that were held were before I even knew how to talk, if I remember correctly. And so, like, how can you consider that an elected people? And then the PLA, I believe they're technically the administrators under the agreement between the IDF and the government there. And PLA has not been representative of the Palestinian people there. So making that dichotomy, making that like under explaining that difference makes sense, because when Israel attacks Gaza, Israel is dropping bombs on a landmass with defined borders that has a mix of people who have a mix of beliefs, mix of alliances. It's attacking Gaza. Versus when Hamas is attacking Israel, it is an organization of people with guns, with community, with knowledge that are attacking the other, like another country, another landmass of defined borders with a mix of people and populations. When it's it'd be, I would have a bigger issue if somebody was saying, Hamas attacked the IDF, because yes, Hamas attacked the IDF, but the Hamas also attacked civilians in Israel. So that, Hamas attacked Israel. But then the IDF isn't just attacking Hamas. The IDF is attacking Gaza. So it's this like separation between, who is the organization? Who is the people? What is the group that you're attacking? Israel makes it clear that they don't care whether or not whether you're Hamas or not, or whether you're aligned or not, or whether you're 2 years old or not. You're in Gaza, therefore you're a threat, therefore you must be attacked. That is something that must be made clear.
So is that something the media's done? I don't want to interrupt and take your time, Liberty, but is that something the media's done to com you know that we've now lumped all of Gaza as Hamas and all, and Israel as Israel? And Israel is the victim in the beginning. I mean, I don't think any of us have seen these pictures coming out of Gaza that doesn't feel that this has gone way, 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 way too far. But so is that something the media's done? It's made us think, Hamas is all and do you think there's a tacit acceptance of Hamas by the Palestinians?
So, okay, I'm going to start with the tacit acceptance question. I think tacit acceptance is a way that I would not put it. I would put Hamas is, I mean, not Hamas is the only militant, only political organization that seems to be we even wanting to represent of the Palestinian people in Gaza. Is it corrupt? Is it violent? Does it take food from like humanitarian drops? Reports have said that they do that. And are they a perfect organization? No. But they're also the only organization within the defined land of Gaza that has the ability to fight for the Palestinian people. So is it, tacit acceptance? No. I would say it's a willingness to allow their existence, because without their existence, there is nobody there that can act as a shield between you and the IDF. Because with or without Hamas, the IDF, I believe, would find a reason to attack Gaza. So that's the first part of the question. Then with the media part, I would say it's a little nuance. I think one part is that every media source in the world has their own biases, their own beliefs that started off, what have you. And so part of it is that like it does make it easier for you to just go like, yeah, Hamas is Gaza, Gaza is Hamas, they're all the same, number of people dying, they're all just
Right.
Hamas aligned. It makes it easier to deal with the depth. That's one part of it. But then another part of it, I think it's just it's a the media and just the world, and I think Americans in general have this tendency to just go like the country is the people is the country. So it's like automatically like, Gaza, government, Hamas, all the same thing. The same way you would call like, back in the time, like when we were still in Afghanistan, you'd go the Taliban is Afghanistan, Afghanistan is the Taliban. We make that equivalence when it's like there's people within Afghanistan who are the Taliban. It's more nuanced in there. There's different power dynamics. And so, like, it's just we like oversimplification, and then this oversimplification helps the people who have certain beliefs. So I think that's why the media is willing to speak.
Liberty, I don't want to monopolize the show here.
No, please. I'm loving your conversation. And that's a really interesting question that you bring up, Chris, about how, first of all, the oversimplification of things, right? And what that means, especially even for post-conflict conversation, how we've internalized this conflict, and therefore how can aid be properly given to the source of the issue if we have not properly understood where aid actually needs to be brought to. I have an interesting question, but because I know this is a very old conflict, and I know that psychologically, I think there's a lot going on here. What role do you think that collective memory plays in shaping the current status of the situation, but also the path towards post-conflict healing and coexistence? What are the barriers in that, and what do you think the solutions would be as well?
Oh, that's a great question. The like collective memory issue, not issue, the phenomenon of collective memory is very, very impactful when it comes to Gaza, Palestine, Israel, and just the greater context of that. You have every Palestinian, whether or not they're alive, essentially remembering the Nakba. You have many people from Israel viewing a predominantly Jewish country provide citizenship to Jewish individuals. They remember the history of the Holocaust very closely. A lot of people from Israel and a lot of people that have ties to Israel have close family members that experienced that. So they both, like, there is this trauma that is there. There is this fear of, or for the Palestinian people, there's this fear of continued loss of land because land continues to be lost. They remember everyone who's lost land. You can still see like the keys of the doors of the houses that were abandoned because of settlers that came in and forced homes out. And then you also know your family members who like died in the Holocaust. So these traumas continue, these traumas exist, and they make people fearful of what they see as the other, whether the other is a true other or it's just what the media, what the government, what those want you to believe, it is still an other. And so there is this need to acknowledge the trauma. You have to be like, yes, this occurred. This is a horrible thing that happened. You cannot act like it was nothing. You cannot act like it's a clean slate now. There has to be acknowledgement of this sort of trauma. And then there has to be this conversation of like, well, what do we do to make this trauma feel like it's not going to happen again? Because that's the biggest fear. You want to make people feel like they're not going to have to leave. You want people to feel like their people aren't going to be attacked on a genocidal level again. And that requires a lot of conversation, a lot of intercultural experience, a lot of willingness to hear each other out, and a lot of requiring each other to listen to each other. No one's going to like, not everyone's open-minded. So sometimes you're going to be like, hey, listen to the other side. But either way, this isn't a 6 month project, a 5 year project. This is decades. I mean, like, there's still so many other traumas and so many other conflicts that we as a global collective haven't gone over yet. So, it's continued conversation and making sure we begin to understand each other's traumas.
Well, let me ask you, Chris, if Netanyahu doesn't believe in a two-state solution and the Palestinians don't believe in a two-state solution, they want C to C, is there another solution? Is two states seem to be what Americans want to see, but is there another solution, an interim solution maybe?
I mean, this is where it gets complicated. And I mean, all right, a two-state solution, personally, I do think would make a lot of sense in the sense that the people there that are there now are there. And I don't want to force anyone to move anymore, whether it be an Israeli person or a Palestinian person. Like, you live there, it's your home now. You can't just reverse that. So a two-state solution makes sense. You get the democracy on both sides if it works out perfectly. But outside of a two-state solution, I feel like what would make a lot of sense would just have one state, one country, one nation, one democratically elected government. And there have been examples of a multicultural, multi-ethnic, multi-religious democracy, the United States. Other
America, right.
examples within the region, Lebanon has had issues, and it's not a perfect example of like an attempt at like a multicultural like governance. But it's saying that this isn't impossible. Not every country has just one people. You can have this multiculturalness and have a democracy. So I think a one state solution is possible. It's just people will have to want it, whether it be, people need to want to have a two one state. If the Palestinians and the Israeli people, whether by a genuinely democratic referendum, or whether it just be by popular opinion, show that they don't want to be one state. You can't force them to be one state, or else this is just going to be continued conflict. So I think you need to keep listening, keep getting this dialogue. And, you know, within this dialogue, you need to make the baby steps of going like, okay, no more violence. Okay, no more land encroachment. Okay, you get voting rights. Okay, you get more and more economic rights. You know, it's like a step-by-step process. But yeah, I think one state solution is entirely possible, but if it's not wanted, it's not wanted. So don't try it.
Liberty?
You know, I think multiculturalism is something really interesting because no matter what conversation we have, the more and more I realize that it really is united we stand, divided we fall. And that's something, that's a really interesting and unfortunate reality that even, it doesn't matter what conflict we assess, that is always, always going to be an aspect. Do you see, so in your view, what does it take to make these people truly feel secure, not just militarily, but, you know, in a in a post-conflict society? And because if it's down to multiculturalism, there's always going to be a sense of divide, you know? So what do you think it would actually take to make people feel heard on both sides of the conflict?
Well, I mean, first thing is that, like, I don't think we'd be able to have this conversation about, like, everyone feeling heard and feeling safe until we stop saying it's both sides of the conflict, you know? It's already putting this dichotomy of, like, you're one, I'm the other, that's it, you know? We're not both experiencing this conflict. We're not both experiencing these traumas. We're not both experiencing what these governments are doing. We're one side versus the other. So, like, we do actually have to start deconstructing those kind of ideas, this, like, thinking. But it is a long, long struggle of education, conversation, multiculturalism. But I think, like, you would be able to say we're getting almost past the conflict once you go, was your like, once you stop asking the question, was your family on this side or that side, but versus, oh, how did your family experience it? Or, oh, you know, is your family still going through what they experienced from the trauma? You know, it's a different question. And I think that would probably be the first sign that, like, the area that's currently known as, like, Palestine and Israel would be going through a post-conflict resolution, you know, once they start to stop seeing the former borders. But, you know, to start having that, you need to first be willing to make the borders invisible. And then you need to be willing to have other structural borders, whether it be income disparity, education disparity, gender disparity, sexuality disparities. You know, you have to deal with all these other issues within a society that the United States hasn't solved within itself. You know, we have to point this out as we're having this conversation. But as you slowly remove these borders and these dichotomies and showing that everyone is who they are now and what they are doing now and what went on in the past, went and occurred in the past and is painful and is traumatic and we are working to repair it, but it is not you versus me or your grandpa versus my grandpa. It is, this is what occurred. We're living it now. And I'm happy to be rebuilding with you.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, you know, I got to tell you, Chris, you're very thoughtful in your answers. And that, and again, that gives me great hope that there are young people out there that may actually be able to solve some of these problems. And let me ask you, what other issues do you think young people really, really care about right now? Do we care that the government seems to want to murder every Venezuelan in a motorboat? You know, do we care that we're rounding up people? I mean, we seem to be, ICE seems to be arresting every brown or grabbing every brown person they can find and then asking them to prove they're an American citizen or dragging them away. What are the big issues? Or are you worried about the future in terms of, are you ever going to have a house? Are you ever going to have a job these days? What are the big concerns that activists, student activists care about?
I would say like big concerns are, yes, the ICE detention. It's a massive issue for especially the progressive population in like my age, but also like even conservative people who like believe there is an immigration crisis say that what Trump is doing is inhumane, unconstitutional, illegal. So this is a cross-party, cross-ideology idea that like that ICE detention is the ICE detentions have been horrible, irreparable, and need to end now. So that's one thing. Then I'd say, yeah, I mean, economically, college students do have this like kind of fear of what's the future in the United States. I remember I was having a conversation with my, father earlier about how like, what's your plan in the future? Because Social Security is going to be empty, by the time I'm dead. What are you going to do? I'm like, I don't know if I'm going to retire. And that's a genuine fear that I know a lot of my friends and I have. We make jokes about how we're going to be in the office until we drop dead. And it's like, some people want to do that, but not everyone does. But there's not going to be an opportunity for us to do anything else. And, it's going to be a renting economy almost forever. And then, right now, especially, I'm a senior, so I'm thinking about this a lot, but supposedly this is the worst job market for new entries since 2008. So that becomes its own concern, its own fear. It's like, what am I going to do 6 months from now? No, that's another thing. And so, yeah, I mean, Trump's economic reckoning is one thing that, like, is a big issue. We don't know what we're going to do 6 months from now because Trump doesn't know what he's going to do 2 weeks from now. And his most minor actions affect how we can exist. And yes, the issue of Venezuela is concerning for a lot of Americans. I don't think they are really knowledgeable what's going on. I think when the first ship that was blown up by the United States military, that was very sensational. But I think since then, it is gained less media traction, and the buildup of Navy armaments and Navy ships. I don't know the exact details, but I do know that there is a larger Navy presence outside of Venezuela now, and I do know that that is an issue that we should probably highlight more because that is a war and right by our like that is the potential of war right by our like our closest neighbors or closest friends with a country that we shouldn't be meddling with as much as we are, and we shouldn't be economically damaging as much as we are. And then there's just the general issue of healthcare. The Trump administration seems to want to slash the budget to like save us from our massive deficit and our massive debt. And rather than, taxing billionaires, rather than reducing military spending, rather than reducing ICE spending, he increases the ICE spending in his one big beautiful bill, and he proceeds to reduce the amount of coverage people in healthcare programs have. And what does that do? That does nothing for the future of Americans, and that hurts every single one of us. That makes the cost of existing, the cost of maintaining our health, so much more expensive. And that is another issue student organizers really need to double down. And because we don't see it now, but come January, everything's going to be more difficult for people who are reliant on the government for healthcare, and that is a big population.
Well, I got to tell you that I've been in politics more than 40 years, and I really have no understanding of how people look at a man who's failed at everything. He couldn't sell steak knives, he couldn't sell college, couldn't sell Bibles, he couldn't sell, and say, this is the guy we want to run the most complex political country in the world. Liberty, go ask another brilliant question.
You are so well spoken that if all else goes wrong, I think you would be a great politician one day.
Me
But
too.
I think that what something really interesting we're seeing nowadays in politics is what I like to call clickbait politics. And so how do you think that the normalization of misinformation under Trump and also mass distraction, let's call it, has reshaped the boundaries between truth, ideology, and political identity in a democratic structure which should lie about the government supporting the people, not controlling the people?
I think, frankly, I mean, pointing the finger straight to social media and like the other just like most recent developments of technology of our like of the 21st century, I believe it has deteriorated the strength of our democratic institution through this. I think it's made it so much more difficult to hold people accountable because there's this willingness to just let a 30-second clip be full of lies because it gets the most amount of engagement. And engagement means views. Views means money. Money means more campaigning. More campaigning means more money. You know, it's like this like constant cycle of like self and like endorsement. And it's also made it possible for people who have no intentions of helping the world, but just intend to be a grifter, a hater on society, their voices are even more well heard and more engaged with because not only do they have these crazy radical thoughts that attract other crazy radical people, but they also attract anger. And it's just anger, but the just anger turns into further engagement. And these, like, our algorithms, our media cycles, it only encourages engagement. It doesn't encourage thought. It doesn't encourage diversity of opinion. And it doesn't encourage morality. It only encourages engagement. And so I think just this constantly get what you call clickbait campaigning, where you want to have that 5 to 15 seconds that's going to be put up on 10 seconds on MSNBC or CNN or somebody's going to see on their Twitter feed. And it's like, that way, you know, you're going to get more social media engagement. And that means the big donors think you're more important. And I think it's turned politicians from people who try to represent and ensure the highest quality of life to influencers, to people who just desire attention and attention only. You know, it's I'm taking an American presidency class, and we discussed how, like, you know, due to certain reforms and due to the expansion of media and technology, the presidency has turned into a permanent campaign. I think you could put that down to like literally any other member of any party who's running for office and any other person who has an even semi-political position. So yeah, clickbait campaigning has made it that disinformation is the most valuable thing because the thing that can get the most engagement is something that makes people angry and seems stupid and wrong. You know, that's what makes people most like willing to engage, and that's what gets the most attention. So like, why wouldn't I just do that if I was running for office? Why wouldn't I say I was a pro-life candidate and I wanted to make a campaign against abortion? I'd be like, I would say the most absurd statistics about how 7 trillion babies have been killed in the past 10 years or 15 years. And it's like, no, but that number sounds scary. That number gets me angry. That number gets me a person that believes that like life is precious, right? At the point of conception, that gets me to want to vote for this person. So it doesn't matter whether or not it's the truth. What matters is how I feel. And what matters is what this person tells me will make me feel safe after I felt this.
I think you hit the nail on the head there, Chris. And let me tell you, when I think, for example, when they say 20 million people have been led into our country illegally, and they don't say just people, they say murder, like every one of them is a murderer and a rapist, right? Well, when you think we're during the Biden administration, when you think we're a country of 350 million people, and that would actually be 5 million people a year, that's probably not much more than immigration, and it's probably much less than the immigration waves of like Irish and Italians and Poles that came in waves, you know. But you're right; it just sounds scary. 20 million people, you know, it sounds like a lot of people. Let me ask you another question. Do you think we hear this all the time that it when Trump uses the slogan "Make America Great Again," I see why it appeals to people my age, white men, for example. Because I'll tell you what, it was great being a white guy in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. You know, I mean, had no complaints about it. That's why I love the people that talk about, you know, being discriminating against white people. But I don't understand why young people fall for that, you know, make America great again. Is it because they don't think they have enough now? And I hear all the time that young men don't feel like they have any place to stand anymore. Their role is not well defined, and they've been left behind because, you know, we all cheered for our daughters, you know, growing up. You can do that, girl, go get it. And men feel neglected. Do you see that in with young men? Did that in college age men, do they feel like they've been left out somehow?
Yeah, I would say there's definitely a disillusionment among men. I mean, the issue is first, there's like men have had declining rates of education, like recently. You know, there's fewer men in college now at like a lower and lower rate, and that's because more women are engaging, but also less men are applying to college and less men are trying to go to college. And there's this odd disillusionment, and I like wouldn't. The what I would put it down to is that we didn't create a place for a man in society after like post-90s. We like didn't really find a place for them. You know, it was we globalized, suddenly there was less manufacturing jobs. We made it so that structurally women felt more liberated and could live on their own and didn't have to be married to a man. And so like all these gender structures were taken out from under men, and like good, these structures that were taken out. You know, women shouldn't have to be attached to them. Women shouldn't need to live with them. Women should be allowed to have their own jobs. But you then take out all these structures underneath man, and then you like underneath any person, underneath, you know, anyone. But you don't put any new guidance in. You don't like find a way for men to have a job when there's no more manufacturing jobs. And they like, once you are equitable in education, actually women are more likely to go to college than men, you know? So then suddenly there's no manufacturing jobs. There's not as many men in higher education. So where do they go for work? So they're disillusioned in the workforce. And then, you know, they become grifters on the internet because they feel like there's no place for them in regular society. And so the only people who really hear them and really feel like they're being heard are other people on 4chan, Reddit, and all these other like more quiet parts of the internet. And so it's these like we allowed globalization, we allowed capitalism, we allowed all these sort of structures to take out the things that made men feel powerful. And it's good that we gradually took out some of these things, you know, like took misogyny out of the system to an extent. There is definitely still misogyny within the system, but you know, it's good that we took part of these things out. But then it's like, well, men have been raised their whole lives thinking they need to be a good provider. They need to be a good husband, a good father. They need to have this big, strong working man job. They need to be able to like, you know, chop wood with an axe. You know, it's just like they need to have all these like weird, like macho provider vibes. And so a lot of these men, especially men my age, I mean, I definitely still have these preconditioned thoughts in my head where it's like I need to be strong, protective, and provider. But suddenly you've stripped everything away from me that can make me feel like a strong, protective provider. I'm useless to society unless I say, no, screw society. Society's actually evil and is working against me. And so then these little Reddit bubbles and 4chan bubbles make that a possible and accepted thought. And no hate to Reddit. I actually do use it often. I mean, to more point it at 4chan.
Well, let me just tell you just qualified for political candidacy on the basis that you just walked through a minefield very, very, very adeptly. I can see that my co-host wasn't happy with the question, but she seems more happy with the answer. Go ahead, Liberty.
That's a lot, you know, that those are crazy things to consider. I think right now we are really facing a lack of role models for men in this world. The question is, did we ever have positive male role models? I don't know. I'm a woman, so but how do you think that how do you think we can fix this equation? You know, obviously they created their system and now they don't know how to deal with the fact that it is failing. You know, is it something bigger? Is it maybe the fact that the system overall is failing? You know, they say that an empire lasts 200 years and America is about 200 years old. We are seeing democracy constantly falling, you know, the system that was created by these men. However, sorry about that. How can we fix this sense of dislocation? You know, is it everyone or is it just that Is it just men? Is everyone feeling a little dislocated and maybe women are more connected to their emotions? I don't know, you know. How do you think we can fix this? And obviously that's not a nice thing to say. I really love you guys, for example, you guys are great examples of men, and I really would like for there to be more male role models out there who could remind us being a man, it could be a really good thing, and not that it means that you can be a criminal offender and still be in office, you know. So what do you think are the paths that we can take to better give men a less of a sense of dislocation as these traditional structures are crumbling and women are finding their own agency without men?
Yeah, well, I just want to echo one point that you said, where it's not just men that are getting disillusionment. It's just men are getting disillusionment, and they tend to have violent tendencies, so it's become more highlighted. But women have also become disillusioned through this capitalism, globalism thing. Now there's a greater rate of single motherhood and poverty in the United States, and those are at increasing rates. Gender inequality still has not been solved in terms of income, in terms of access to healthcare, in terms of just access to education, freedom generally. Women still definitely have it difficult. I don't want to, and women have also been hurt in their own ways through these same structures. But the next steps would be first to just restructure what it means to be a man or a woman or a person in society. It's like, a man doesn't mean be the breadwinner. A man doesn't mean be the big macho man protecting him. A man just means being a person that's comfortable in yourself, being a person that is willing to show love for others in the way that others need to be shown love. A man is someone who is willing to sacrifice the time and the resources that they have for those that they care about. You have to change it from this weird macho, I need to punch in every man that looks at my girlfriend or partner the wrong way, to I need to have a conversation with my partner about what makes me uncomfortable in the public. It's like you gotta change what it means. Because right now, the issue is that a lot of people my age are stuck with the old definition of being a man that worked for father's generation. And it only worked for my father's generation because it was a structurally misogynist society to a much greater extent at that point. And it also just was very permitted, and it was very encouraged. And that was okay. But now it isn't okay. And it should never have been okay. And so you just have to teach men that was never the right way to be a man. The right way to be a man is to be a good person. There is nothing that you have to do more than that. You don't have to suddenly be this hairy chested, girls attracting macho guy. You don't have to be like Barney Stinson from How I Met Your Mother. You just have to be you, and you have to be comfortable, and you have to be willing to show up. And that's a battle. That's difficult. That starts with their parents. Kids' parents have to start by showing them that you don't have to be macho. That means, stop doing the whole every time a kindergarten boy talks to a kindergarten girl, don't be like, oh, that's his girlfriend. Stop with that kind of stuff. And it's also start with going start teaching boys how to understand their emotions at a younger age. We have still failed to do that as a society, and we still gotta so part of it's on parents, then it's also our education system. Stop letting just boys be boys. Don't have different standards for activity, and don't have different standards for behavior between genders within the education system. And then we also need to learn how to take men who have done wrong things, people who have ended up incarcerated for one reason or another, and learn how to listen to them and see what structurally got them there, and show them the way out and provide resources out. Because if they end up back outside of prison, they're only going to teach the younger, and they don't change their ways, they're only going to teach younger generation the ways that they know and the ways that got them to prison. So it's a multi-stakeholder effort. It takes me telling my friends to stop making dumb bro-y jokes and dumb bro-y comments. It takes the random friend to, make their bro stop having misogynistic comments. It takes a father's slapping his kid over the head saying, hey, don't be a dumbass, respectfully. You know, like it takes a lot of time and it takes a lot of effort, and we're forever away from like fully solving this issue of like what is a man in society today. But it takes conversation and a willingness to change.
Well, first, let me modify my earlier statement and say it was not only great being white in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, it was great being a guy too. It was a much easier path. I've seen a lot of women. I was raised by women. I've seen a lot of women struggle just because they are women. So it's nice that we've changed these things, and I hope we can find a place for men. I hope you're absolutely right. And I gotta say, if I had to give advice to a young man, I would say feeling comfortable in your own skin is the single most attractive thing you can do. People are attracted to people that have confidence in who they are and who are comfortable in who they are. Let me just ask you one more question before I let you, because we're running out of time, before I let Liberty ask you the last question. But if you could change one thing, Chris, what would it be? If you could change one thing in our society or in our government, what's the one thing that you'd want to change?
This is going to be so cheesy, but
That's all right. We like cheesy.
okay. I think people have, like, I would change that everyone is emotionally, like, change it to that everyone has emotional intelligence. Like maybe not like be like an empath or like, oh, I can feel everything everyone feels, but going like, I think a lot of people, especially in government, Donald Trump, lack emotional intelligence, and that really impacts how you're capable of functioning in this world and what your thoughts on this world can be. So if every single human being in the world can suddenly, to the capabilities that they can, like begin to understand just like how someone else feels and like understand where that feeling could come from and have like the complexity to understand the nuance of a person, I think that would get us so many steps further along to like a peaceful, sustainable society.
Liberty, you want to ask one more quick question before we're off the air?
That was so beautifully put. And, this makes me proud of the current system. At least college students are getting a really good education because I agree with everything you said. Not everything, but mostly everything. And I think that was wonderful. And if we had more empathy, I think the world would be a much better place. But you
And I
can't
think you.
sell empathy. That's the issue with a capitalist society.
You can't.
No, and I think that if the Trump, if the MAGA people lack anything in sufficient quantity is empathy. It's terrible. Well, Chris, thank you for being with us tonight. I think you, like I say, you give me great hope for the future. It's nice to see college students who are so thoughtful and considerate in their answers. And so knowledgeable about what's going on in the world. I used to protest the Vietnam War when I was in college, but I had a vested interest in it. And at times, I think we just did it because we thought it was a cool place to meet girls. That usually didn't work out very well. But anyway, it's good to see somebody so concerned. And so we hope you'll come back again sometime really soon. So thank you. I'm going to play out the show every week with a song. And tonight I'm going to take a moment of personal privilege and play a song for a dear friend of mine. She's beautiful and talented and brilliant and just very, very kind. And her birthday's tomorrow. Here's Julia by the Beatles.